Hello, everyone, and thanks for hanging out with us for the Behind the Numbers weekly listen, eMarketer podcast. That's a good time for the voice to go. Try again. It's the weekly listen. You know, because you clicked on it. An eMarketer podcast made possible by Mountain. This is the Friday show that reviews the most, one more time, media and retail news stories of the week. I'm your host, Marcus Johnson. In today's show, how much longer can Google own the internet?
From a regulatory framework, I am interested to see if any of these antitrust actions against Google bear any kind of fruit, but I'm still kind of like just waiting to see if anything real happens.
Is buy now, pay later in flux?
That can be a problem long term, but for the time being, there's a consumer interest in these financing options, so still fairly bullish on BNPL.
Why big tech needs live sports?
What I'm wondering is, how saturated can it get before it just becomes like a recreation of the cable TV environment at the end of the day?
How best to market to Gen Z people? An unpopular opinion about buying things on social media? And what is the main reason that gas prices go up? Join me for this episode. We have three people. Let us meet them now. We start with our director of reports editing. You can call him Rahul Chadha.
Hi, nice to be here, Marcus.
Hey, chap. We're also joined by the vice president of briefings. It's Stephanie Tagliannetti.
Hey, thanks for having me back, Marcus.
Hello there. And finally, we are joined by a director of forecasting. It's Oscar Orozco.
Hey, Marcus. Happy to be here.
Hello, hello. There wasn't a ton of enthusiasm in your voice, Oscar. I'm not going to lie.
I'll say it again. Hey, Marcus, happy to be here.
No, you've overdone it. You've overdone really? It. It was too much.
You oversold really? It.
Oh, yeah, unbelievable. Let's just get on with the show.
I'll do it a third time. Do you want me to? Hey, do Marcus, happy to
no,
be
I'm
here.
No, I'm kidding. Don't do it again.
Hey, Marcus.
It means nothing anymore, okay? I know you're not happy to be here, but you have to be. You don't
I
have
am.
To be, but
I'm
you are anyway.
Happy to be here. Victoria, pick the right one.
It's also just a window into Oscar's acting skills. I'm like, is he really excited to see me? Or
I've heard that tone before.
Thanks, guys.
What do we have in store for you? Well, four parts as per usual. The first part is the story of the week. We'll talk about how much longer Google can own the internet. We move to the game of the week, where Stephanie, Oscar and Rahul will compete for the championship belt by giving us the best answers they possibly can. We then move to uncommon knowledge. We talk about some unpopular opinions. We finish with dinner party data, where we talk about random trivia we've just recently learned. Let's do it. We start with the story of the week. How much longer can Google own the internet, writes Recode's Sarah Morrison about a month or two ago. She is talking largely about how a bill called the Competition and Transparency in Digital Advertising Act could, if passed, stop any company with over $20 billion in digital ad revenue, basically Google or Meta, from owning multiple parts of the digital ad chain. Google would have to pick between being a buyer, a seller, or running the ad exchange between the two. It currently owns all three parts, she points out, which some say it uses to unfairly manipulate the market, hence the legislation. State and federal governments have filed four antitrust cases against the search giant, all within a year of each other. And Ms. Morrison points out that if you combine the lawsuits, every state, because there's a lot of attorneys generals, don't know how to say that properly, but you know what I'm talking about. A lot of those, if you combine all the lawsuits, every state except Alabama, plus Puerto Rico, DC, and Guam, is suing Google over its search business. So everyone who's an attorney's general, they're all suing Google. Let's talk about how much longer Google can own the internet, legislation or no legislation. Rahul, what do you think?
You know, it's interesting. Google, we just published the Power of Google report, and we kind of struggled with the number of business units we wanted to describe in the report. And it kept sort of ballooning and ballooning. And it's not reflective of how Google categorizes its business units. It was really reflective of how we think about how Google interacts with the world. And I think it is really reflective. You know, I think a lot of attention is paid to Amazon in this regard. Google kind of gets left out of the conversation, but it is staggering to think about how many aspects of our online lives and experiences Google either touches or outright mediates. You know, there's antitrust, you reference these antitrust issues that are going on. You know, there's, I think, good arguments to be had that, you know, Google is suppressing competition in certain regards and visiting harm upon consumers through lack of competition. You know, that's supposed to be create the sort of foundation in an open market that allows for better services and products to arise that serve consumers. So, you know, I am interested to see like what happens. I think historically, social media has been the political football that's gotten kicked around a lot from a regulatory framework. I am interested to see if any of these antitrust actions against Google bear any kind of fruit, but I'm still kind of like just waiting to see if anything real happens, you know, just out of cynicism about our political process these days.
Yeah, a big part of this is saying that the Google, you know, owns the internet is because it's kind of our window into using the internet. A lot of times people fire up Google search, as well as obviously a lot of other ways that Google has its fingerprints on our internet experience, whether that's owning Android, which half of people in the US use to power their smartphones, or using Gmail every day. But yeah, inertia is a big part of this. Miss Morrison points out that DuckDuckGo, a rival search engine that has a key selling point of privacy, has just a fraction of the market that Google does, in part because it can be hard for users to switch their browser's default search engine, which is almost always Google. It's usually buried in their user settings, and that assumes the user even knows that you can switch, that there is a different way to search for something that's not Google. Stephanie, your thoughts on how much longer Google can own the internet?
Yeah, the briefings team has been covering this a lot, especially around all of these regulations, legislations. Earlier in the month, the team actually covered that Google did concede to regulators with the proposal to separate off parts of its business in response to the Competition and Transparency in Digital Advertising Act. At the time, Jeremy Goldman, who is the director of our marketing and advertising briefing, wrote that while the DOJ's antitrust regulators have shown a preference for substantial changes to Google's ad tech operations, it's unclear whether any offer other than asset sales would actually satisfy them. And at the same time, you know, Google is trying to argue that TikTok is a search competitor to deflect some of the heat. I found that interesting, by the way, that many Gen Zers do prefer to search on TikTok rather than Google. But the fact that Google is making proposals to compromise its ad tech business, proposing concessions in the EU, directing some attention over to TikTok, it shows that the pressure really is intensifying, and we're uncertain whether the standoff between it and the DOJ will come to an end.
It's going to be interesting to see whether they can convince the government that, yes, TikTok is the competitor, because
right.
It just doesn't seem like Google has any competitors. However, if you look at where people start their searches when shopping online, not just looking for stuff online using maps or other things, but when they start their search to specifically shop online, 61% say Amazon. 49% say search engines, that's likely Google. 32% say Walmart.com in third place. TikTok was actually eighth behind most of the major social networks, but did have 11% share in terms of where people start their search when shopping online. And to your point, Stephanie, I'm sure younger people a greater share of
that. Yeah, I was going to say the point I was referencing in particular was Gen Z's preference for TikTok over Google in particular.
Mm-hmm. Oscar, your thoughts?
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack here. I mean, going back to that comment on TikTok, I mean, if the DOJ knows at all what they're doing, they won't fall for that, because it's just not the case. Like, TikTok is by no means a competitor. Going back to what we were talking about, just the legislation, I mean, I think the first place for anyone who wants to track this closely is to really look at the EU, right? Because they're a few steps ahead of us here. In November 2021, Google did lose an appeal on an almost, it was about $2.8 billion fine in an antitrust case there. So they're still appealing that, and it's going up to the European Court of Justice. So I think a lot of what we'll see happen across the globe, you know, here in the US, will be determined by how things go for them in the EU there. But circling back to the point of, you know, how long or will Google always own the internet? And just think about our everyday vernacular, just the word Google, how it's become a verb, you know, and how we use it. And I think the answer is, I don't see how it's ever gonna, you know, lose importance, or, you know, unless it really does come back to regulation. And as Rahul said, and I totally agree, you know, my cynicism as well points to the fact that I don't see that happening in the short term. And, you know, just one other thing, looking at our sort of ad revenues, I mean, we do consider the Meta Google duopoly. And the only thing that we predict is that it'll become a triopoly with Amazon in the future. Mm-hmm. So really, I mean, this big tech dominating the ad world and just, you know, the online world in general, I don't see that going away anytime soon.
And in particular, on the ad side, Oscar, net search ad revenue, search in particular, if you look at before the pandemic, Google had 60% net search ad revenue, 60% of the market. In 2 years' time, it will have fallen to 50%. Amazon would have taken that share from Google, according to us, close to 26%. So in 2 years' time, Google with 50, Amazon with about 26%. However, Google's dollars are still way, way, way up. So it's not affecting how much money they're making. It's just Amazon getting into the game, particularly in search. And Oscar, you mentioned about losing importance. You can't see Google losing its importance in society and in how we interact with the internet. Also, their level of influence, according to a May 2021 Ipsos poll, search engines are the most influential source of information, search engines, when it comes to convincing someone to buy something. More than shopper reviews, reviews from friends and family, online videos, or ads. Search engines was top of the list. So we've got time for the story of the week. It's time now for the game of the week. First quick word from our sponsor, Mountain. Television advertising shouldn't be hard. That's why Mountain's self-serve platform makes advertising on connected TV easy and effective for all brands, big and small. With access to premium streaming networks and technology optimized to drive performance, you have a new way to drive website visits, conversions, and every other metric that matters. Visit mountain.com to learn more. Folks, we're back. It's time now for the game of the week. Today's game, What's the Point? Where I read out four stories and have contestants, Stephanie, Oscar, and Rahul, tell us what they think is the main takeaway of the story. Okay answers get 1 point, good answers get 2, and answers that give you the same feeling as when you really lean into a stretch. You know that feeling. Answers that leave you with that feeling, they get you 3 points. Each person gets 20 seconds to answer before they hear this. Technical foul, if you go long. Minus 2 points. Two technicals gets you ejected from the game. Whoever has the most points wins, gets the last word. Let's play. We start with Stephanie. Buy now, pay later in flux. Buy now, pay later, BNPL. Industry is in flux amid inflation and potential recession, writes Adweek's Patrick Culp. He notes after an explosion of adoption during the pandemic online shopping boom, the BNPL space is experiencing growing pains in the US as people and investors tighten their purse strings amid the economic uncertainty, he writes. Yet, Morning Consult analyst Charlotte Principato said the share of folks who reported using BNPL in the past month has not fallen below 16% in 2022. She thinks the downgrade in BNPL company valuations has more to do with a correction in financial technology and startup markets than trends in shopping. Stephanie, BNPL in flux, what's the point?
I mean, yeah, the headline is startup valuations tumble, investor funding dries, which is said about a lot in this economic condition. But BNPL in particular is grappling with regulatory scrutiny, competition. There's been some fallout. We saw Zip pull the plug on its Sezzle acquisition as one example recently. Our analysts expect there to be even more fintech consolidation coming. But it's worth noting that consumer and retailer interest isn't going away. We actually forecast that BNPL sales will grow 17% to $143 billion through 2026. So not all gloom and doom.
Oscar.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm still fairly bullish, and I think we are here at Insider Intelligence. One of the key things to look at is retailer partnerships, and we're seeing still a lot of that. That's really the key for these services to continue growing. I don't know if you guys have shopped in store anytime recently, but they're, you know, front and center when you're checking out. There's that option. One thing to keep in mind, though, is card link solutions or retailer branded ones. So, you know, we're seeing the Visas, the MasterCards, the Amexes getting involved in this short-term financing. That can be a problem long-term, but for the time being, there's a consumer interest in these financing options. So still fairly bullish on BNPL.
Rahul.
Yeah, I think I take more of a mixed view. You know, I think as the economy worsens, these kind of services are going to be appealing to more people, but probably like not the target people that these services want to target, meaning they're going to be people who are their credit stressed. You know, BNPL becomes the last option sort of for them. I think that means, you know, it has effects for their business model. You know, I think it just increases the chance that people are using these services are going to default on their repayments. You know, I think there's a mix of revenue generating streams out there. Sometimes the retailers bear the cost of partnering with these services. Sometimes the consumer bears the cost if they default on the payments. But I think at the end of the day, it's probably going to be bad news for everybody.
We move to our second round. We start with Oscar. Why big tech needs live sports? A recent New York Times piece writes that emboldened by their deep pockets and eager to boost viewership of their streaming subscription services, Apple and Amazon have thrust themselves into negotiations for media rights held by the NFL, MLB, Formula One racing, and college conferences. These tech giants are competing to replace DirecTV for the rights to NFL Sunday Ticket, the article notes, which is a package the league wants to sell for over $2.5 billion annually. That's $1 billion more than it currently costs. Oscar, why big tech needs live sports? What's the point?
This is timely, actually, with the recent announcement that the NFL is launching NFL Plus. So, you know, everyone is launching some sort of service with a plus at the end. But, you know, of course it makes sense. When we see surveys on why people are not cutting the cord, right? So many people are still paying for pay TV, cable, satellite. It's because of live sports. So it makes sense for the big tech companies with their big pockets to sort of get involved. A couple of our own forecasts that highlights why, you know, the big tech is getting involved. 47.5% of the population is a live sport viewer. That's 160 million Americans. So still a lot of appetite for that type of programming. Even within the article, they mentioned that 95 of the top 100 most viewed programs on TV last year were sports programs. So, you know, makes a lot of sense. They just have to focus on providing the product and making it look as good as, you know, we've come accustomed to seeing on our big TVs and on, you know, cable TV.
Oscar goes long. Technical foul on Oscar. Negative 2 points, unfortunately. It was a great answer.
Okay.
But you went long.
By like a second?
No, not by a second. It was a minute and 10 seconds, to be specific.
Whoa.
Unbelievable. Oscar wants a review. He throws the challenge flag. Comes back. Still
just
a
like,
foul.
Just like in the real NFL. Can't
yeah,
win
yeah,
one.
Still a foul. Yeah. Okay. Pick up your challenge flag. We have no time for that here. Rahul, your turn.
I don't know if I have that much more to add. You know, live linear TV's protective mode has historically been these kind of live events, meaning largely sports, but also, you know, events like the Emmys or Oscars or something like that. You know, on the other side, I think streaming services know the value of these live sports, and if they can lock them in, they can reduce churn. You know, everybody and their cousin is launching a streaming service. I think the market for streaming services is a bit panicked now that Netflix is reporting subscriber losses. This is a great way to reduce churn. And I think it's hilarious that a former Disney exec was crying foul that, you know, these deep-pocketed tech companies are outbidding a company like, you know, some older companies. You know, it's just a free market. That's how it works. This is the future. These tech companies with wads of cash flow in their pockets are going to lock in these rights.
Stephanie.
Yeah, I mean, to Raul's point about saturation, there's big tech's bidding for the Sunday ticket. The NFL is going to exist with its own streaming service, with its own, like, really confusing set of perks and restrictions. So what I'm wondering is, how saturated can it get before it just becomes, like, a recreation of the cable TV environment at the end of the day?
That's a great question. The halfway mark, Raul has 6, Stephanie with 5, Oscar with 4. We move to our third round. We start with Rahul. Online shopping is bananas confusing, writes Shira Overday of the New York Times. She posits a number of questions regarding e-commerce. Will internet buying return to the fairly steady growth of the 10 years before COVID? Or has the pandemic permanently turbocharged our e-commerce lives? Or how about, will the hermetic habits learned in the pandemic's early phase continue to influence our shopping? Rahul, online shopping is bananas confusing. What's the point?
Yeah, I think we're just in
the middle of a mixed bag situation. Everybody's in a different place. We're still figuring out the new normal. All the economic data signals we used to use to sort of prognosticate what is happening or is going to happen are just kind of all mixed up. I think some of the data I've seen and reports I've edited indicates that, you know, a lot of these changes are maybe category specific, like people are more apt to buy health and beauty or consumer electronics products online as a result of the pandemic, but that behavior is sort of sticking around. And then it's snapping back to pre-pandemic for other categories. So yeah, you know, I'm not sure there is a clear takeaway here other than we're just in a place where we're sort of figuring out what the new normal is.
Stephanie.
I mean, you know, brands are actually still really optimistic that e-commerce growth will continue despite the in-store resurgence. We just covered a survey saying that brands plan to spend more on e-commerce initiatives than ever before. But yeah, I mean, it's hard to imagine a reality in which the last 2 years don't permanently impact people's online shopping behaviors in favor of e-commerce, but you know, I'm not an expert there.
Oscar.
Yeah, I agree with Stephanie and Rahul. I would just add though that I do think the article is a bit misleading. I think sure the pandemic accelerated the shift to e-commerce, but looking at our own estimates, e-commerce share of retail sales, they were flat from 2020 to 2021 at about 14.6%. But again, that's because of that huge acceleration because of the pandemic. But there was no dip as or you know what they said in the article, online shopping losing ground. I don't think that's the case. We do expect it to reach almost 18% in 2 years' time. It's all about omnichannel now, but you know, people are still shopping online. That's not going away.
Mm-hmm. After three rounds, heading into the fourth and final rounds, Rahul has 9 points, Stephanie and Oscar tied with 7. So it's all to play for in double points round 4. Marketing to Gen Z, we start with Stephanie. In a recent Inc. article, Shi Tian Tina Wang writes about 3 marketing lessons from Gen Z's favorite brands, 3 of which include Amazon, Nike, and Shein, according to design automation platform Creatopy. They say that those are 3 brands that Gen Z love. Those 3 marketing lessons that Ms. Wang writes about are 1, prioritizing speed and efficiency. Young people expect you to make their lives easier and they have shorter attention spans than most. 2, advocate for social change. Gen Z prefers brands that are inspiring and not afraid to get involved in social issues. 3, skip overly polished marketing. They want authenticity, so partnering with members of the Gen Z community, including nano and micro influencers, is the way to go. Stephanie, marketing to Gen Z, what's the point?
Yeah, it's my impression that this generation just has an extremely low tolerance for BS in marketing. You know, it's really clear when a brand is trying to stay on trend or meet Gen Z where they are. So brands really have to figure out what makes them authentic and lay that out on the table. Brands like Fenty and specifically Savage X Fenty come to mind in becoming popular with Gen Z for aligning to their values of inclusivity and representation as just one example.
Oscar.
Yeah, call me a bit, I think, underwhelmed for the second story in a row here a bit. The first thing I thought of is this reminded me so much of how we described the millennial generation 10 to 15 years ago. It was kind of the same marketing ploys. Let's keep in mind that there are still Gen Zers who are 10 years old, 11 years old. They're still coming of age. So almost 50% of the generation is not even an adult yet. So a lot is still to be determined. Ultimately, I think what companies and brands should think about is just where they're spending their time and kind of what products they like. Right now, it's all about brand loyalty and maintaining that as they do increase their purchasing power in the coming years.
You say how we describe millennials 10 to 15 years ago. 10 to 15 years ago, you were in high school.
No, you would think that.
You weren't describing anyone. You were the people.
Marcus, we've been working for that long now.
Crazy? That's true.
But it's the case when we came out of school, you know, it was like same story.
Yeah, it does sound familiar. Rahul.
Yeah, I think 2 of the ideas that this writer identified are old ideas. Who doesn't want speed and efficiency? You know, authenticity and marketing is just a really old idea. Maybe the key differentiator is a social issue thing, but I think Oscar's right. I think we talked about this issue with millennials as well, specifically related to that issue. You know, brands are operating in a minefield. You can take an issue and you're just going to run the risk of alienating and angering some segment of the consumer base. You know, that's just the cost of doing business these days.
And that is all we've got time for the game of the week. We tally up the scores with a drum roll. Rahul is this week's winner of the game of the week. 13 points to Rahul, Stephanie and Oscar, 11 apiece. Very close game. Well played, folks. Rahul, you get the championship belt. It's very imaginary. And the last word.
Oh, I want to shout out this year's Tour de France. It was a really amazing race this year. One. Jonas Vingegaard took it home for Belgium. Jumbo Visma was like an incredible Wout van Aert. Watching him just, you know, tow Vingegaard up the Alps was incredible. It was a great race. Watching Pogacar crack for the first time that I had seen was really exciting. All around exciting race. I guess maybe it's too late for people to watch it, but it's worth going back and watching some of the highlights if you have any interest in, as a spectator, watching another person ride a bike. Highly recommend it.
Will you watch like just the very end part, or you'll follow it the whole time?
No, I'm selective about what I watch. I mean, the coverage sometimes is 6 hours, you know, and some of the flat stages and not a lot of stuff's happening. And, I watched it on Peacock this year, so I could kind of fast forward to some of the sprint stages in the mountain, mountain when they're vying for the King of the Mountain points, that sort of thing. Yeah.
Cool.
That's a good one, man. That's a good one. I saw a few clips, didn't watch as much live as I wanted to, but yeah, incredible. I love the Tour de France.
Well, congratulations. You are King of the Mountain today. That's all we've got time for the game of the week. Rahul's the winner. We move now to the surprise question giveaway. So we're going to give away some free stuff. Well, it's not some free stuff. It's one free thing. We're not that rich as a podcast, for crying out loud. I'm going to read out a question in a second. All you have to do is email the correct answer to podcast@emarketer.com and send us a screenshot of your review of this podcast, and you can win a free mug. So correct answer plus a review equals free mug. Here's the question. Who is the number one best-selling solo music artist of all time? Any guesses?
I mean...
Oh, Oscar. Very nice. Oscar got it correct. To people listening, if you think you know the answer, then send correct answers into podcast@emarketer.com plus a review of this podcast. It can be an old one if you've played before. And you can win a free Behind the Numbers weekly listen mug. Abby won last time, so we'll see who's next. You also have to send it in first. It's not everyone who gets it right gets one. We get very few entries. So don't feel like, oh, I'm not going to enter because I'll... No, if you enter, there's a massive chance that you'll win. So, yeah, the first person to send it in, and if it's correct, then you win. It's time now for Uncommon Knowledge. Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge, the segment where we offer up some unpopular, or I don't know why I yelled that, sorry. We offer up some unpopular or typical opinions about things. We start with two unpopular opinions from the internet. And finally, we get an unpopular opinion from one of our panel related to the media or retail worlds. So two for you from the internet. First one, it's time to stop saying bless you after you sneeze. So just for context, why do we say it? There's two theories that I found. One, in more superstitious times, it was believed that when you sneezed, it separated the soul from the body, which is intense. God bless you was said to release the soul from the devil and return it to you, its rightful owner. The second reason is because it comes from the Great Plague. As sneezing was one of the first symptoms, God bless you was used as a response. Should we stop saying it now, though?
I don't know if we should stop saying it, but I want a ruling on... My wife is a serial sneezer, meaning she like sneezes like four times in succession. Do I have to say God bless you every time? Can I wait till the end? Is it okay if I get distracted in the middle of a series of sneezes and just don't say anything?
I usually cut off after two and then say that's enough.
Yeah, you're on your own.
But it's awkward with a stranger. You can do that with people you know, but after the second time, if they sneeze the third time and you don't say it, they look at you like, what's going on?
I'll say you're at your limit.
You hit your quota.
Yeah, that's it.
You're done.
Oscar. I'm done. What's done. The alternative? Just being silent?
Nothing.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
You have to say something. You have to, I mean, what's the other option? If you come up with a better word phrase, I'm all for it, but have to say something.
Another one for you real quick. Naps are not as fun as people make out. I agree. I don't know how people do it. How like a mini sleep can make you feel refreshed. I feel annihilated after I wake up from a nap.
Well, it's like all about the timing of what phase of sleep you enter. And like if you interrupt the non-deep sleep, then you're not going to feel refreshed. So I wouldn't call them fun though, but more like necessary sometimes.
Okay. I think it has to do with intention. Like I'm not an intentional napper. I'm like, I fall asleep on the couch, you know, watching the tour or something. Those I'm like here for. I'm like super into my couch naps, but like I'm not the kind of person who's like, I'm going to go climb into bed and take a nap right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Accidental ones are good. A surprise nap. You're like, oh, wasn't expecting to catch a few hours. Oscar?
I'm biased here, right? The Spain connection, but siestas are incredible. They're the reason behind
a proper nap. You guys have really wrapped your arms around that.
Oh, for sure. And it's the reason why there have been so many successes for the country over the decades and centuries. So all for naps. Naps are great.
Is that why you guys are so good at football? Is that what you're saying? That you're so good at football because of the naps?
No, football is why we can work late into the day. Yeah, so many positives.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's move now to one from our panel. This kind of comes from everyone. We were just talking about this and thought this would be a good one to talk about. So buying things on social media is our unpopular opinion. And it seems like, I might have characterized it wrong, but it seems like we don't think it's great. And we're not as bullish as some people may be. And by some people, we have some numbers on this, Oscar, your team put together. Social buyers, someone who's bought something on social this year, is over a third of the country somehow. 103 million people. By 2026, 4 in 10 of us will have bought something on social. Oscar, is this once a year, maybe, I'm assuming?
Yes, it's once a year.
Once a year via any social channel, Facebook, Instagram, Pinterest, TikTok, etc. What do we think, folks?
Yeah, I mean, I would like to see the chart that says how many purchased after that purchase, because I'm somebody who has made a social purchase and then like been extremely wary of doing it again. I find myself building my cart within Instagram and then abandoning because it just doesn't look very official. The merchant page that I'm on, it's a little sketchy. I have some like trust issues with the seller that I'm unfamiliar with, and I ultimately will just go see if it's being sold on Amazon maybe because I trust them a little bit more.
Yeah. Rahul, your experience, thoughts?
I mean, yeah, I'm not heavy social media user, but my wife did have the experience of buying something from a direct-to-consumer brand. It was like pretty bad quality. She was unhappy with the product and tried to return it, and that became a nightmare trying to get like some customer service connection. You know, I think there's a difference between companies that are just like pumping up their social media buys to sell stuff direct to consumers, and then an ad that might link you to like a more established D2C brand or retailer or somebody else. The other thing I think is funny, Stephanie remarked on this prior to our recording, but how kind of great the targeting can be sometime. And I think of my friend who, you know, just the targeting holds up a mirror to himself and he doesn't kind of like what he's seeing. It's like, you know, the targeting has got him pegged so well. And he's like, oh my God, am I really like that much of an outdoor hipster that I need this like bespoke like bronze carabiner, you know?
Oscar, any experience here?
I believe, you know, maybe 6-7 years ago, I bought like a San Francisco 49ers t-shirt off of Facebook. I don't really do it a lot. But from, you know, looking into this space a lot, going back to what Rahul mentioned, a lot of it is based off ads that then lead you to a much more sophisticated interface, right, on a retailer's site. So I think it does come back to like the one-click shopping, just making that easier. But also, I guess, the product quality itself, which is what you guys are all saying. So we'll see. We'll see.
All right. We will indeed. That's what we've got time for Uncommon Knowledge. Of course, it's time for Dinner Party Data. It's the part of the show where we tell you about the most interesting thing that we have learned recently. We start with Rahul because he is king of the hill and he also won the game of the week. Rahul, you're up.
Yeah, I think I've well established as a non-sports person, but you know, like I said, the Tour de France is a sporting event that I do watch. So some fun facts about the Tour de France. The first one was held in 1903. If you don't know, the riders ride the race in 21 stages, and it's a total of 2,000 miles they ride this year over 3 weeks. It's just incredible, honestly, feat of like physical performance.
Wow, that's two-thirds across America.
Yeah, it's insane.
That's insane.
And that's not including the elevation gains that these guys are doing in the mountain stages. It's incredible. The winner of the overall best time or the leader of the overall best time wears a yellow jersey, which takes its color from the newspaper. And apologies to French-speaking people out there. La Auto.
with the paper.
I nailed it.
I can hear like French speaking people all over the world just turning their phones off right now. And, you know, the thing, one of the factors that's most interesting to me is just the range of drugs that the riders used to take in the early days. And we're talking like early 20th century here. So they would take everything ranging from alcohol to cocaine to like sort of, which in those days were considered performance enhancing drugs to sort of numb the pain and increase their endurance and maybe just, you know, stimulate their bodies.
Yeah. Very good. Very good indeed. I might have to watch next year. I'm intrigued now. Stephanie, you're up.
So when I was researching brands that have done a good job marketing to Gen Z, I found a few of the favorites from earlier this year that differ from some of the ones you mentioned, which I thought were surprising, honestly. So this comes from Ad Age and the Harris Poll. Some of their top brands include Whirlpool, Hostess, and Hertz. And in reading more in the survey, Ad Age says these brands all deployed strategies to reach Gen Z, including working with influencers, actors like the cast of Bridgerton, creating personal like brand TikTok accounts, and highlighting sustainability efforts. So clearly the key to reaching Gen Z is Reggae Jean Page.
It's the key to reaching everyone. Wait, did you say Hertz? The car
Hertz,
rental
like
company?
The car rental company. I thought Whirlpool was the like curveball there, the like appliance company for...
That is a curveball, but also isn't Hertz a curveball considering no one in Gen Z can rent a car?
Remember, but 10 year olds, 10
but year their old. Perception of the brand is very good, I guess.
Yeah, wow. Tom Brady helped with that, probably. Very nice. Oscar, what you got?
Well, with all this hot weather here on the East Coast, but I mean everywhere really around the world, cranking that AC, I've had issues sleeping. You know, it's just harder in the summer. So I wanted to see if there was some sort of study on this. And of course there was. There's always a study on that, on everything. But what I found was really interesting. It was good to see because it proved that, you know, my sleeping issues were, you know, I'm not alone in this. But essentially, scientists in Denmark found that increases in nighttime temperatures do have a meaningful effect on sleep quality. So a study published by One Earth, which worked with these scientists in Denmark, said that a person could lose over 50 to 58 hours a year in sleep by 2099. And as we know, medical professionals do encourage us to get at least 8 hours of sleep a night. So that could be an issue. Essentially, they were analyzing data from over 45,000 smartwatches and wristbands in 68 countries around the world. So this is a global study, and they found that out. They also basically found out that women, elderly people, and low-income populations are the most affected. So people over 65 are more sensitive to increases in nighttime temperatures. And they also found that females' core body temperatures decrease earlier in the evening compared to males, which exposes them to higher temperatures when asleep. So it affects women even more. So climate change is having an impact on just about everything. But I thought this was super fascinating.
Yeah, that is. That's no small amount of hours. You said close to 58 hours a year.
Yeah, yeah. That's a lot. Adds up.
Especially if a lot of those are clustered in the warmer months.
Exactly.
Yeah. Wow. I found it fascinating that we're the only species on the planet that will actively stop ourselves from going to sleep. Like every other animal will just be like, it's time to sleep, I'll sleep. And we're the only ones who are like trying to stay up and drinking coffee. And yeah, which is insane because you can't, you just lose those hours. There is no getting it back.
Exactly.
Just doing it to ourselves, yeah. I'm the biggest culprit. What am I talking about? Very nice. Very nice indeed. One for you real quick. Carmen Ang, a visual capitalist, recently put together a piece explaining what influences gas prices. Let's talk about gas prices and going up, and boy, has it ever. But why? Why does it go up? Why does it typically go up? Not just now, but why in general does it go up? So 4 points, there's four pieces to this puzzle, and they make up 100% of the reason. So the first piece, just over half, so 54% of gas prices are influenced by the cost of crude oil. Some folks may have been able to guess that, but over half of gas prices influenced by the cost of crude oil. 16% of the cost of gas is influenced by taxes. California is the highest taxed state for gas, followed by Illinois, Pennsylvania, Hawaii, and New Jersey. A 16% similar share is distribution and marketing, and then 14%, the remainder, 14% of gas prices is influenced by refining costs. Half of America's refining capacity and 8 out of 10 of its largest refineries in the country are all located along the Gulf Coast. The national average price for gas now sits at $5 a gallon. By the end of summer, it could reach $6, according to estimates by JP Morgan. By next year, it could reach $3 million a gallon by my official, unofficial estimates. It just won't go down. Anyway, that's what we've got time for the episode. We'll end on that positive note. Things costing all the money. Thank you so much to my guests. Thank you to Stephanie.
Thanks, Marcus.
Thank you to Oscar.
Thanks for having me, Marcus.
And thank you to Rahul, this week's winner of the Game of the Week.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
We thank Victoria, who edits the show. We thank everyone listening. Please send answers to the surprise question giveaway to podcast@emarketer.com, along with a screenshot of your reviews to win the free mug. First correct answer wins. The question was, one more time, who is the number one best-selling solo music artist of all time? We'll see you guys on Monday for the Behind the Numbers Daily, an eMarketer podcast made possible by Mountain. Happy weekends. One second before I do that, let me pull up scorecard. Boop, boop.
Really have a scorecard?
Yeah, I do really have a scorecard. It's so depressing.
Susie.
Stuart was like, you don't really keep score yet. I was like, no, I actually keep score because of Susie.